Respondent's counsel to continue the direct examination of Dr. Rutter.
Sir Michael. Isn't that right?
Yes, yes.
Doctor, before we go on to the next topic, I'd like to just finish up with discussion of the epidemiology. Before we broke, you were talking about how, given the proportion of regression in autism, it would likely have been detected by the epidemiological studies. What are you basing that statement on?
Oh, on the evidence that in the studies overall, the rate is about 25 to 30%, or sometimes even up to 40%. So it's a big enough number to make a difference overall. So if one was talking about something that only affected, say, 1% of the population, that would be quite different.
Is that based on your understanding of what you know about autism in general?
Yes. Okay. Yes, indeed.
Now, in your report, you state that there is no good evidence to support the speculative suggestion that thimerosal results in a form of ASD characterized by regression. Could you please explain what you mean by that statement? In 10 words or less.
Well, the suggestion, as far as I can see, is not based on any empirical evidence that that is the way it happens. If it were, it'd be quite different. So it's difficult to know how to comment further, other than that is just speculation.
Are there any reliable biomarkers that represent a measure of susceptibility to thimerosal?
No.
What evidence would be needed to demonstrate a susceptible population to thimerosal?
You need some test which would show that in response to ethyl mercury, you were having an unusual reaction. So that, in theory at least, it would be possible to develop a test of that kind. But so far as I know, there hasn't been such a test that's been applied to determine whether that is the case. And the studies that have been done that we were referring to earlier of human populations looking at high doses, what is quite striking is that it does seem to affect everybody. It's not that you're finding unusual individuals who are showing a big response, and most individuals no response at all. So it's not like the nuts example that I gave. And the animal evidence similarly seems to show something that applies more generally rather than only in a small subgroup. So although there have been suggestions that there may be particular susceptible populations, the evidence is singularly unconvincing up to now.
Doctor, I'd like to talk now about the theory that has been espoused by Dr. Marcel Kinsborn in this litigation. Did you review the report that he submitted?
I did.
Okay. And on page 14 of his report, he states, and we will put this on the screen for you, "The late onset of the regressive subtype and subsequent remission or relapses become more understandable if autism is due to disease than if it is the aftermath of congenital maldevelopment." Do you agree with this statement?
No. I mean, it comes back to the point we were discussing earlier, that both prenatal or genetic influences will affect course as well as the occurrence at the time of birth. So it's a non sequitur. It does not follow logically from what we know about the way biology works.
And earlier, we put on the screen a quote from Dr. Kinsborn's report in which he described regression as striking. Dramatic. Is that characteristic of all regression in autism?
No, to the contrary, it's often very subtle. There are examples where it is very striking and dramatic, I agree, but they actually are very unusual rather than the opposite way around. That's to say, the usual picture is of reasonably subtle changes that amount to something that is very worrying, appropriately worrying to parents, but it doesn't occur dramatically in either the sense of it was not there on Tuesday, but it is there on Wednesday, nor is it a question of a loss, as it were, that is so severe that it's obviously a total change in the child's behaviour. That can occur. I have seen cases like that, but they are distinctly unusual. It is a more gradual occurrence of a milder kind, which is the more typical.
Now, beginning on page 13 of his report, Dr. Kinsborn discusses what he believes is a neuroinflammatory response within the brain due to accumulated inorganic mercury in the brain. And he states, and we'll put it on the screen, ASD has traditionally been regarded as a static neuropathy or encephalopathy that originates from before birth. If that were so, it would be unclear how autistic regression can occur as late as the second year of life and even later in childhood disintegrative disorder. Is this a correct assumption on the part of Dr. Kinsborn?
No.
Why not?
Let me come back to the schizophrenia example that I gave, where the evidence is strong of a major genetic influence, high heritability, but where there are early manifestations, but then later changes. And that the follow-up study, for example, by Judy Rapoport and her group at NIH, has shown that schizophrenia has both early manifestations and changes later. So that what is being described here as very exceptional and unusual and causing a problem in terms of understanding is actually something that one sees in many conditions. I would agree that we don't understand what is going on in the brain at the time that happens. An encephalopathy sort of implies an inflammatory process, and we don't know that that's what's happening. So when I say that clearly something must be happening in the brain, I mean the workings of the mind have to be based on what is going on in the brain, but exactly what those changes are and whether they're structural or functional, we don't know that.
Now, Dr. Kinsborn describes what he terms his over-arousal model as an explanation for autistic behaviors. Are you familiar with this discussion of his over-arousal model in his report?
Yes, I am. It is, of course, an old theory, I was surprised to see this put forward as novel. So the Tinbergens, in a report back in 1972, put forward a closely comparable model, in which they were arguing that autism was not a disorder of social reciprocity. It was a disorder of emotional over-arousal in relation to social situations, which is pretty similar to what he is suggesting. So it's an old theory. It no longer even gets referenced in textbooks, so that, for example, the two-volume handbook of autism edited by Fred Volkmar and colleagues, you won't find it even in the index, let alone anywhere else, either under Tinbergen who is the most prominent proponent of that view, or in terms of emotional overarousal. So it disappeared simply because of the contradictory findings, which did not really support the notion.
Now, Dr. Kinsborn cites a paper by Goodwin, which is Petitioner's Master List 496, and a review paper by Barron, which is Petitioner's Master List 550, in support of his model. Do these articles provide reliable support to Dr. Kinsborn's over-arousal model?
No, I don't think they do, actually. The fuller review is actually in the Goodwin et al. Paper rather than in the Barron chapter in the textbook. And in that, they review the numerous methodological problems that there has been over the years assessing arousal and of tying it to anything in particular, so that there are different physiological measures that one needs to use. Whether somebody looks aroused is not the same thing as whether from a physiological point of view they are aroused. Showing whether or not the arousal is in relation to social situations rather than more generally becomes another issue. So it's quite a good review of the multiple difficulties. They then go on to a comparison of five individuals with autism and five comparison individuals, where they present some quite interesting findings, but they are based on a tiny number, and they land up really with the same kind of inconclusive findings that the earlier research had shown.
Dr. Kinsborn also cites a paper he published with the first author by the name of Liss, L-I-S-S, which is Petitioner's Master List 373. Have you reviewed this study?
Yes, I have.
And do you have any comments with regard to the validity of the study?
Well, it's a questionnaire study, so that it's looking at what parents have reported about various phenomena, some of which are concerned with children's responses to sensations and matters of that kind. It's something that's been looked at for a very long time, so that the work of Ornitz back in the 1960s and early 70s was trying to do exactly the same thing. So the questionnaire is new, but is very similar to earlier ones, but they're based on observed children's responses, then not measuring actual responses to sensory stimuli. And so that you're having to rely on making inferences as to what the observed behaviors might or might not mean. He refers, for example, somewhere, I can't remember where in the report, to the study by Lovas looking at overselectivity, which received a lot of publicity at the time, but Lovas's own research, as well as those of other people, later went on to show that this was not specifically associated with autism. It was a function of the low developmental level, and once you took that into account, the association with autism disappeared. It's another example of, in this field, of needing to consider carefully what the possible confounding factors are, and the need also to be concerned that the behavior which you think is dealing with over-arousal is specific to the social situation. So the fact that autistic individuals get over-excitable sometimes, certainly that's been known from Kanner onwards. The fact that autistic individuals can sometimes also appear apathetic, again, known from Kanner onwards. So the need is to go beyond that to try and link it up with what is happening physiologically and how that relates to the specific social situations. And that's what is lacking. The Ornitz view of perceptual inconstancy, which is sort of brought in the Liss paper a bit, he abandoned later because the evidence really didn't support it.
For the overarousal hypothesis to account for social abnormalities in autism, as Dr. Kinsborn suggests, what would have to be shown about the nature of arousal responses in a social situation?
Well, you'd want to have a physiological measure of arousal rather than just an account, because we know from animal studies as well as human studies that what you observe and what you can measure in terms of heartbeat and EEG changes and all the range of things that measure the physiology of arousal don't necessarily coincide. So you'd want that. And you'd want to show that the over-arousal is something that applies to social situations, because if it doesn't particularly apply to social situations, it's difficult to see how it could account for the problems in social reciprocity. So one's not trying to explain autism as something which is generally due to being too excitable or not excitable enough. It's in relation to social. That's what's not been shown.
And in your opinion, has Dr. Kinsborn explained how overarousal leads to regressive autism only?
No. In fact, it's quite striking by its absence in his account. That's to say, in laying all the emphasis on regressive autism and applying it particularly to overarousal, I assumed that he would go on to explain how the overarousal might lead to this interesting phenomenon of regression. But as far as I could see, that wasn't present in his report.
Now, Dr. Kinsborn has stated that toxins and viruses and other metals can all operate to initiate this inflammatory response in the brain that he's talking about. Do you think that this lack of specificity supports his hypothesis in this litigation?
No, it doesn't. One of the famous set of guidelines for causal inferences put forward by the British statistician Bradford Hill included specificity as one of the things that didn't prove causation, but was a pointer in its direction. So that the lack of specificity doesn't disprove causation, but it certainly is not in support.
In your opinion, how would you describe Dr. Kinsborn's hypothesis as to what might underlie regressive autism?
Interesting, but entirely speculative.
Doctor, in your opinion, is it more likely than not that thimerosal causes regressive autism in a subgroup of genetically susceptible children?
No, I think the evidence suggests it does not.
And do you hold that opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
I do.
And finally, just one last question, Doctor. Why did you agree to fly to the United States and testify here today for the United States government?
Well, because I think the scientific issues are important ones and the public health considerations are very important. And the issue of identifying environmental causes of disease, including autism, has been a special interest of mine for a very long time, and it's something I know a good deal about. So it seemed to me I had a duty to do that.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Petitioner's counsel, are you ready to commence cross?
I am.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Rutter. I am Michael Williams, representing the Petitioner Steering Committee here today. I want to start by asking you a kind of general question about what you think underlies autism in the brain. In particular, do you think that for all the children who meet the DSM-4 criteria, they have the same underlying brain pathology?
I think we have no idea. But let me answer it in a slightly different way, that the history of medicine and of medical genetics indicates that heterogeneity rather than homogeneity is the rule, so that one must expect both that there may be different ways of reaching the same endpoint, and that within a population there may be different patterns. So now I don't assume that there will be one, and we have no idea at the moment what the neural basis of autism is. A host of interesting ideas, but that's what they are.
Because I think I heard you say at least once, maybe twice, that you believe it is medically plausible that a postnatal insult of one kind or another could trigger or contribute to the development of symptoms that meet DSM-4.
Yes, as I follow British rules in preparing my report, which is that I must be scrupulous in looking the evidence against and the evidence for with equal thoroughness, and that is what I've tried to do. I think that the evidence on postnatal causes, and I gave the example of the herpes encephalitis a week, they are clinical case studies which I don't actually find very convincing. I included them, though, because they have been claimed to illustrate how a postnatal cause, indeed very late, one of them was adolescent, can cause autism. Now, the problem, of course, is is one talking about a cause of autism as we ordinarily understand it, or are we saying there are similarities in some of the features? And I certainly accept there are similarities in some of the features. I am less certain that this actually means the same sort of thing as autism as we ordinarily understand it. I'm cautious about saying it couldn't happen because early postnatal factors could have an impact. I think the particular examples that people have put forward are not very convincing.
Isn't it medically reasonable to think that if you had two children, one who before the age of 12 months is showing lack of eye contact, failure to respond to social smiles, no words at all at age one, compared to a child who seems to develop normally until 18 or 20 months of age, isn't it medically reasonable to think that there may be a different etiology to those two different patterns of the development of autism?
That is one possibility, but I don't think it's medically reasonable if by that you mean that that would be a strong assumption. I put it the opposite way around, the issue as to why one child does and one child doesn't is an important question for scientists to examine, and the evidence to date doesn't actually show systematic differences. I would instantly have to go on to say that the studies that have been done are really quite few and quite limited in what they have looked at. So we are not in a position of being sure that they are due to the same factors in the same way, but by the same token, there's no evidence that they're due to different ones.
Now, I want to show you page 11 of your report briefly. You can pull that up.
Thank you.
And I want to focus, Scott, on the paragraph 16, the bottom of the page.
Yep.
And if you would, if you'd highlight the sentence that begins, first, there is a tendency to assume.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you a question in just a second, Doctor. I just want to highlight the sentence I want to ask you about.
Okay.
This sentence says that there is a tendency to assume that if the heritability of a liability to autism is as high as 90%, this leaves little room for any major environmental influence. And then you say, it is crucial to appreciate that this is a wrong assumption. Now, when you say major environmental influence, what were you referring to?
Well, the example in my evidence earlier was of height, where height is strongly heritable, but yet improvements of a major kind in nutrition and in infectious disease were associated with a big increase in height. There are other examples, but...
Phenylketonuria, PKA disease, is another example, isn't it?
Well, that hasn't changed over time, but that is an example, you're quite right, that where the genes actually work through susceptibility to a particular food substance.
Now, I want to show you an announcement of a grant proposal by the Department of Health and Human Services, the respondent here. This is... was published in the Federal Register while this trial was going on last couple weeks ago on May 23rd. Let's just show the top first there, Scott. This was out of the Federal Register on May 23rd, 2008. And then go down to the title here, Scott, where it says disease, disability. It says disease, disability, and injury prevention and control special emphasis panel. Associations of Vaccine Adverse Events and Human Genetic Variations, request for proposal, and it gives the proposal number. And then it lower in the same announcement, it says there's going to be a conference call on June 12th, a couple weeks from now, and the matters to be discussed, if you'd highlight that, Scott, that's what I want to ask you about. It says the matters to be discussed include the review, discussion, and evaluation of proposals already received in response to associations of vaccine adverse events and human genetic variations. Now, are you involved in any way in these proposals, or will you be involved in this discussion?
Now, the reason I'm looking up is... see whether I've got anything down on June the 12th. I haven't. So not only do I have no memory of being involved, I obviously am not involved in that discussion.
The respondent didn't think it needed your advice on this yet, apparently.
Just for
the record, this is from the Federal Register, Volume 73, Number 101, page 30105. Now, Dr. Rutter, you may not remember this, but you actually attributed autism to an immunization in one of your papers. Do you recall doing that?
No, I don't. So
let me show you.
Please remind me.
Yeah, sure. This is a review paper that you wrote back in 1994. I guess we're going to make a trial exhibit next. And I've got a copy to show you.
No.
Oh, okay. The one on autism and known medical conditions, yes?
That's going to be petitioner's trial exhibit number 8.
Okay.
First, let me make sure that is you that's the first author there.
Is indeed.
Okay. And... The general subject here is autism and known medical conditions, myth and substance. And if we turn to page 314 of this paper, which is the fourth page of the exhibit, down at the very next, almost at the end of the column, Scott, where it says only 8 of the cases. Mm-hmm. You highlight that.
Yes.
There, that's good. Now you're actually discussing in this paragraph a review paper that you had published, actually a study you'd published back in 1993 on a systematic investigation of 100 individuals with autism. And you say here that only 8 of these cases can be regarded as having a probably causal medical condition, one being a child with epilepsy and temporal lobe focus on the EEG who had an onset following immunization. You see that? I assume that was a case of regressive autism, wasn't it?
I have no memory as to whether it was or it wasn't. I'm sorry, I can't help you on that.
Wouldn't you have checked to see if there were any signs or symptoms of autism prior to the immunization before you attributed it to the immunization?
Well, I'm not attributing to them. I'm simply saying that of this group, this is one of a small number with a probably causal information. Now, we know that there are adverse vaccine reactions. They are rare, but they are real. So I don't have any doubt about that. The paper here doesn't specify what the vaccine was. What is striking about it, it was associated, however, with the onset of epilepsy and a temporal lobe focus. So that the fact that occurred, i.e. it's not just that autism arose, but that there was a neurological feature there that plausibly was connected with the immunization is the reason I put it in that probable causal group.
And in this case where it was probably caused by the immunization, you don't know whether there was thimerosal in that vaccine or in the vaccines that child had received?
Well, it pretty certainly wasn't because of the time when these cases were seen. So these these are dealing with the twin and family studies in the 1970s. So that's before MMR and before thimerosal was widely used. I don't know is the answer.
Okay.
But it's not likely to have applied to either MMR or thimerosal.
Okay. You can take that down. Now, just a few questions about head circumference and head size. You discussed it briefly in your direct, but is your opinion that head circumference is a diagnostic tool that you can use to determine whether a child has autism or not? The pattern of the head circumference changes?
Putting it as a diagnostic indicator is putting it more strongly than I would wish to do. The meta-analysis undertaken by Eric Korshan, going right across studies, showed that the increase in brain size, because this was a meta-analysis, I think I'm right in saying, of structural brain imaging, indicates that it is a robust finding, which is distinctive of autism, as distinct from other conditions. Why do I hesitate before saying it's a diagnostic feature? Well, because, of course, it doesn't apply to all autistic individuals. So that it is very different, for example, from the microcephaly that you see with Rett syndrome or the microcephaly you see with many cases of intellectual disability. The fact that a particular individual showed this increase in head size. Let's suppose we've got all the evidence, okay? Showed an increase in head size or brain size measured by imaging over the preschool years would certainly be a strong pointer to this being likely to be autism rather than something else. An absence of that wouldn't necessarily rule out autism.
In the studies that have measured head circumference in association with autism, do you know whether they controlled for the time when the birth head circumference was taken?
You mean which era in time? You
mean does it matter at what point after birth the first head circumference measurement is taken for these studies?
Probably not, because the changes are quite small at that time. But usually it is measured at birth. That certainly in the UK would be the standard pattern.
Right. You called Dr. Kuchane, Eric Kuchane, is that how you...
Yes.
Is that how he says it? Or do you know? I thought maybe you're the authority on autism. You might actually have met him and know how to pronounce it.
I have met him. I think that's how he pronounces it.
Because some of the defense experts have referred to him as Kuchesny. I just wondered if we'd like to know how to pronounce it.
I've never heard him called Kuchesny, but I'm open to correction.
Okay.
For me, he's Eric Kuchane.
Now, coming into this trial, we looked really, really hard to try to find some kind of an animation of brain growth from birth to 2 years of age. Could you just summarize the brain growth that does occur after birth up to 2 years of age in the normal child?
That's not something I've personally done, so I hesitate before giving a summary on that. And, of course, the studies are based on not multiple measures taken over short periods of time. They're putting together ones taken over a longer period. I doubt that the evidence is sufficient to say precisely when this occurs, other than that there is not an increase at birth. As far as I know, none of the studies have found an increase at birth, and it develops sometime over that preschool period. Whether the timing is consistent from child to child, I don't know. But I'd be surprised if it was, because so few things in biological development are consistent from child to child.
I was trying more to get at the notion of just the amount of brain growth that would occur in a normal, healthy child from birth to two, in terms of the increase in volume, the increase in the number of cells, the increase in the number of connections.
Oh, well, there's more evidence on that. So that it is a time when, let me put it in simple terms, where there's an overgrowth of neurons and an overgrowth of neuronal connections. And this is in line with what I was saying earlier about biological development being a probabilistic model. And so what normally takes place during that period, but also takes place again in adolescence, is that there is a pruning, so that the connections that aren't working properly, aren't necessary, are pruned out. So whether the increase that you see in autism is due to a failure of normal pruning, or whether it is due to an overgrowth, we don't know at the moment. Either is a possibility.
Pruning is required, though, for a healthy, normal brain.
Yes.
And isn't it likely that environmental insults during that period of time between zero birth and 2 years of age could affect the pruning as well as the overgrowth of neurons?
It's possible. I think we don't have evidence whether it is likely, but it's possible.
Now, I checked your report again over the weekend to make sure I was right about this, but you discussed for a couple pages of your report a number of brain autopsy studies on autistic children.
Yes.
But you do not mention any of the studies that have found neuroinflammation. For example, you did not cite the Vargas 2005 paper. Why did you leave that out?
No particular reason. I think that I only became aware of the Vargas paper after I had done the report. I have read the Vargas paper now. You will understand that I'm not a neuropathologist, so that the detailed findings on that are go beyond my expertise. But yes, I am aware of the paper.
And in your direct testimony today, there wasn't anything about neuroinflammation as an explanation of the symptoms of autism. Do you think that neuroinflammation is irrelevant to the discussion of autism?
I think we have no idea whether it's relevant or not. I mean, if one turns to the Pardo paper, which reference is made in Kinsporn's report, I think, and one looks carefully at what is said there, they report interesting changes, but they're very careful to point out that the meaning of these remains quite uncertain at the moment. And insofar as I understand the evidence, I would be in agreement with that. So, as is often the way, when one's got new findings, particularly ones that are not the same as what has been found earlier, one needs to be very cautious as to what conclusions to draw. And whether the findings are causal or are caused by or are due to some incidental thing, we really don't know that. So, of course, I pay careful attention to this evidence. I go along with Dr. Pardo's caution as to what it means.
Dr. Corshane has written a paper that we've showed several times during this trial called Autism at the Beginning, where he discusses neuroinflammation as an explanation not just of the symptoms of autism but of the brain pathology underlying autism. You didn't mention that in your report. That was also published in 2005. You don't mention that in your report or in your direct testimony. Why not?
It's not an area of my expertise, so I have noted some of the key findings. On my reading of the evidence, the neuroinflammation does not show clearly what changes are happening, nor when they're happening. And so that the early Kemper and Bauman findings, for example, did not show evidence of that kind. Were they wrong and the more recent ones right? I have no idea. Techniques have improved over time, so I'm open to the open to be persuaded that the new evidence, as it were, needs to be taken seriously as a real contender. But I am aware of the uncertainties as to what causal implications you can draw from it.
Do you know whether Dr. Kemper and Dr. Bowman looked for neuroinflammation in those earlier brain studies?
I don't know. They certainly look for glial changes, but that's not quite the same thing.
You do agree, don't you, that the studies that have looked at brain function in live autistic children, as well as the studies that have looked at brain pathology, seem to imply that there is a system abnormality in autism, as opposed to some focal brain lesion.
I do agree with that.
Isn't neuroinflammation throughout the brain a plausible biological explanation of that system's abnormality?
trouble with biology is almost anything is plausible. So the question that I would want to ask, is it likely? And that the kinds of brain-wide changes that one sees, could they cause autism? Well, I suppose so. But if one looks at what we know about, for example, I was involved in studies of head injuries where there were global effects from closed head injuries as well as focal effects. Autism did not appear in any of the cases that we saw, although because that was a major interest of mine, we certainly looked for them. So a brain-wide general thing like inflammation, could it occur? Yes. Do I think it's likely? No.
By the way, you mentioned a two-volume textbook on autism by friends of yours, or just earlier today.
Fred Volkmar, right. Yes.
If you look in the index to that two-volume book, neuroinflammation is not there yet. Is that just because the UK is behind, or?
It's an American book.
Published about 2005, right?
Yes, 2005.
So it hasn't had time to put this stuff in there yet.
Okay.
The word microglia does not appear in the index of that book.
Okay.
Does that surprise you?
It's not my book, and I'd hesitate to comment. There are a lot of things that aren't there. At the time the book was written, the notion that autism might arise in this way had not received much attention, and it's now received attention through being put forward in this case. It hasn't got much scientific attention as yet.
You don't think it has? Well, let me show you an NIH grant about it.
Okay.
Let's pull that NIH grant out, Scott. This will be, we got just one exhibit, or we got two? Just one, okay. And this will be trial exhibit next, nine. I'll give you a copy of this too.
Okay.
Let's highlight the title of the grant for Scott. This is a study that the NIH has funded, and it's actually recruiting participants as we speak on minocycline to treat childhood regressive autism. Were you aware that the NIH was funding studies to look at regressive autism? Antibiotics?
No, but it doesn't surprise me. NIH are expected to fund long shots as well as surefire applications. So, yeah, it's one of the things they're looking at. But it's an open-label study. It's not a very tight study.
Do you know what minocycline is?
Not in detail, no.
Okay, let's look at what it says the purpose of this study is. Highlight the first paragraph there, Scott. It says there's a subgroup of children with autism that appears to develop typically for a period of time and then loses social or language skills or regresses. A recent study by Vargas and co-workers at Johns Hopkins has demonstrated that this regressive type of autism is associated with chronic brain inflammation, as shown by an abnormal production of inflammatory cytokines and other abnormalities. Now, I can represent to you that this grant, it is the Pardo group that obtained this grant. We we thought we were going to hear from Dr. Pardo today, but we're not going to now. So all we can go by is what the grant says. But I want to show you what they're trying to treat here and ask you if it makes sense. In the second paragraph, Scott, highlight that last sentence where it says, a medicine with anti-inflammatory properties may be beneficial for children with regressive autism. You agree that's a reasonable study to undertake, Doctor?
Yeah, I think the NIH has funded, over the years, a number of studies which were very long shots. And that's a proper thing for them to be doing, so that they funded, I've forgotten how many, but a large number of studies of a claim based on three cases in UCLA that fenfluramine made a massive difference to autism. Fenfluramine, as you probably know, was later withdrawn because of its toxic properties. But a lot of money was spent testing this study. Secretin, a lot of claims were made. A variety of studies were done to test whether that was so or not. The studies were consistently negative. So over the years, NIH, in an entirely proper fashion, has taken some suggestions of varying degrees of plausibility and implausibility and considered that, okay, it doesn't sound very likely, but on the other hand, we need to know whether, in fact, it works. And I would see this as one of those. I don't criticize that. It's obviously not based on very strong evidence, but it's worth a try.
And let me just show you what they believe the target of the drug is on the second page here. Let's blow up this paragraph. It says that the antibiotic minocycline is a powerful inhibitor of microglial activation.
Yep.
Now, what is your understanding of what happens in the brain when microglia are chronically activated? Dr. Rutter.
It's not something I'm expert on, so I'd rather not comment on that.
And then I'd like to show you a diagram that we've used in court before from the Pardo group. This is out of the 2005 review paper by this group from Johns Hopkins. I need to show him a copy of the paper if I can. This is petitioner's master reference list exhibit. Put my glasses back on. 424.
Thank you.
This is a review paper written by Dr. Pardo's group at Johns Hopkins, published in 2005. Have you read this before?
Yes, I have.
You didn't cite it in your report.
Nope.
You didn't discuss it on direct.
Nope.
Let me show you the diagram that they have in here that kind of summarizes their theory. And I want to ask you a few questions about it. It's on page 8 of the exhibit, up in the left-hand corner.
Sorry.
Oh, we gave him the wrong one? Okay, let me give him the right one. Yes.
Okay.
It's not 424?
No, it's 72.
Okay. Give us just a minute. You got a copy. I can give this to him.
Yeah.
Just brief.
I'll get it back.
Yeah. I'll give you one that we've highlighted. As long as you give it back to me, we'll be done.
Sure thing. On looking at this paper, I realised this isn't the Pardo paper I've seen, but I'm interested to see it.
I'm sorry?
You'd asked me whether I'd seen this particular Pardo paper.
Yes.
And I realise, although the title is similar to one I have seen, that isn't the one that I'd seen.
Okay, so you have not looked at 424 before?
No.
All right, now let's look at Exhibit 72, which is the one I intended to show you.
Right.
And ask you first, have you read that paper by Pardo at all?
Yes, I have.
Okay. But again, it's not in your report. Not cited in your report, is it?
No.
Let's look at the diagram on page 8 then, the upper left-hand corner. Now, over in the left-hand top circle or oval, they have environmental infections and toxins. You see that?
Yep.
And then they have arrows going, interacting with genetic factors. And you agree that's a reasonable hypothesis, that environmental toxins would react with genetic susceptibilities?
I'm not quite sure what you mean react with. If you mean that there will be both, certainly. Whether you're implying a gene-environment interaction, I don't know. There's no evidence I know of in support of that.
Is it reasonable to think that there could well be people who are more susceptible to the toxic effects of mercury than other people because of their genetic makeup?
It's possible, but has not been demonstrated.
Then the diagram also points over to the CNS, that's central nervous system, correct?
Sure. Yes.
And it has neural organizations, synapses, and neurotransmitters. And then it points down to neuroglial activation. You see that?
Yes.
And that points over to the release of cytokines, oxidative stress, systemic cytokines. You see that?
Yes.
And then eventually it comes down to the autistic phenotype of regression. They list some other ones there, but now do you think this is a reasonable model of how some autistic children could develop autism, that environmental toxins could activate their microglia and lead to autistic symptoms of regression?
Well, if one looks at the subtitle, it's hypothetical interactions, and that's exactly what it is. It's a speculative portrayal of what there might be. And some of those arrows are better substantiated than others. I mean, let me focus on one that you emphasize, neurotransmitters. One of the very striking things about autism is that unlike all other psychiatric disorders, there is no consistent response to drugs that have been least used so far that affect neurotransmitters. So that it is very unusual with a disorder which we've agreed is likely to be a systems disorder of one kind or another, that features such as neurotransmitters that operate throughout the brain are not beneficially affected by the drugs that alter those neurotransmitters. So that would be one aspect of this diagram where you'd have to put a major query, and that the many of the other arrows are the same sort of thing. So scientists quite commonly follow the pattern of telling stories about how things might be. That's a legitimate way of beginning in science. You tell a story and then you undertake the systematic research to tell you whether that story is correct or incorrect. So as a speculative story that might apply, it's a reasonable starting point. But as the paper goes on, if you look at the conclusions, it is evident that they are putting it forward in a very cautious way, quite properly so. They're not saying it's wrong. They're saying these are some ideas that we think are worth testing. I'd agree with that.
But you didn't think it was worth discussing in your report.
I hadn't come across it at that time.
Right. I'd like to turn to page 17 of your report,
okay,
where you discuss, and paragraph 25 specifically is what I want to blow up on page 17. And you talk about two concepts here, biological plausibility, we've already discussed, but what do you mean by biological coherence? That's an additional requirement you would impose on an explanatory theory?
It's not my terminology. It is a way of restating Bradford Hill's guidelines, in which what he is meaning by this is that if one looks at what we understand from empirical studies of the way systems work, is there a coherence in the evidence coming together to indicate pathways that might be relevant? It is a guideline. He's quite explicit in these guidelines. These are not rules. But it is saying you need to look at the biological evidence as a whole, is there a coherence in it coming together to the same sort of answer? Where it is, then that makes it a bit more likely. Where it's leading all over the place in different directions, then that makes it a lot less likely.
What I'd like to show you now is sort of the five or six pieces of what our expert's theory has been, and then ask you if it looks like it's more coherent than not. Scott, if we this is a slide that we've prepared called Biological Plausibility and Coherence of Thimerosal-Containing Vaccines Regressive Autism Link. And the first point is this. If you pull it in, Scott. We've seen evidence that thimerosal-containing vaccines deliver inorganic mercury to the brain of infant monkeys. And you cite that infant monkey study in your report. In fact, you say that it's interesting enough it should be followed up upon, don't you? Now, who should be doing the following up on it? Do you think, for example, that the manufacturers of the vaccines that delivered mercury to the brains of these infants have any responsibility to do studies to follow up on that Burbacher infant monkey result?
Oh, I think I'd rather not comment on who should be doing it. What I said in the report I stick by. That's to say, it's an interesting finding, and therefore it's certainly worthwhile to be followed through. Now, in terms of the issue of a highly unusual, susceptible subgroup, the comment that I would make is a twofold one. The first is that, as I understand the animal data, what one is seeing is not very unusual responses in a few animals. One is seeing a response which is broadly comparable across the group, so that in terms of evidence that mercury is doing things to the brain, fine, I have no quarrel with that, and of course there are a lot of other studies that show the same. In terms of an unusually susceptible subgroup, I find this, insofar as it goes, rather against that. The second problem is that, as the study and other studies bring out, interesting things happen to both ethyl mercury and methyl mercury and the breakdown to inorganic mercury, and that one in looking for specificity of effects, the minute you are looking to things that come up from all sorts of products other than thimerosal, it becomes much more difficult to say what is causing what. So it is an interesting study. Yes, I do think it's worth following through. At the moment, I don't find that it helps me very much, other than an interesting bit of good science, in knowing about thimerosal.
Well, if you can't say who should do the follow-up, can you say what kind of follow-up you would recommend? If the vaccine manufacturers on their own came to you and said, we're concerned about the fact that our vaccines probably delivered inorganic mercury to the infant brains in a lot of kids, what should we do to investigate that? What would you tell them?
I don't do consultancies to drug companies, partly because I'm not a toxicologist. That's not what I do.
Okay, so what, when you said in your report that it should be followed up, what did you mean? Did you have something in mind?
There are a whole series of ways in which one might follow things through, but I think you're taking me down a road where I have ideas on the sorts of approaches, but I'm not a toxicologist, and I don't wish to get involved in saying it's this strategy rather than that strategy that would be preferred.
Okay. Now, the next step in our coherence that I'm positing to you is that, it should say, Scott, there's the mercury persists in the brain. I think that got left out. But in the Burbacher infant monkey study, that I meant to have the third point be the second point, but in any event,
deal with both of them. Yeah,
in the adult monkey studies that are referred to in the Burbacher infant monkey studies, there was a series of papers that found inorganic mercury persisted in the brains of adult monkeys for years, and it provoked neuroinflammation. Now, you don't cite any of those papers in your report. Did you go and look at them when you read the infant monkey study?
No, I didn't. Because, as I say, these are studies which are at an early point of indicating that there are aspects of the way mercury operates which require further study. I agree with that. But as they stand at the moment, they don't help very much in relation to the particular hypothesis of thimerosal and autism.
And you do agree, don't you, that there is wide individual variability in the blood and brain levels of mercury in both the human and the primate studies that we've seen?
There is wide individual variability in almost any biological measure one cares to think about.
And there is with mercury, brain and blood levels from thimerosal vaccines, right?
Sure.
Next point, Scott. The Burbacher paper says that mercury, inorganic mercury at doses only 5 times higher than the shown in the infant monkeys, ignited neuroinflammation in the brain of the monkeys. And you don't disagree that that happened, do you?
I haven't looked at that particular paper, but I see no reason to disagree. What I would not have the expert knowledge to know is whether the 5 times higher is a sufficiently big difference to make one not wish to extrapolate or not. I can't answer that one.
Okay. Then let's pull the other points up, Scott, that neuroinflammation has been found in almost all the brains of human autistics when it's looked for. Do you agree with that?
No, but... The point is that the number of brains that have been looked at is very small. Moreover, the brains that have been looked at are highly atypical. And that's not meant as a criticism of the research. It's simply you can only look at the brains of the people who died. And the people who died are much more likely to have epilepsy and to have profound mental retardation or intellectual disability, because those are the ones who die. So it's not that they've chosen the wrong groups. It's the only groups that are available. So we have small number of brains looked at from an atypical group. Now, whether The findings that are found are related more to the epilepsy than the autism. We have no idea. It's with the number of brains available at the moment, it'd be pretty well impossible to sort that out statistically. But clearly that will have to be done. And as I'm sure you know, there are studies both sides of the Atlantic trying to accumulate larger number of brains so that issues such as the one that you mention here, but umpteen others as well, can be looked at. And in order to determine, can they be found by independent investigators, because that's the golden rule of science, and can they be related to the particular aspect looked at, i.e. not the mental handicap, not the epilepsy, but the autism, because the groups have mostly had all three of those, and have the right checks been done to determine whether it is a cause or whether it is an effect of the changes that take place. So, as an area where more research is needed, absolutely, I agree. In terms of what can be concluded so far, I think very little.
You seem to suggest that you were aware of autopsy studies on autistics where the investigators had looked for neuroinflammation and failed to find it. What study are you talking about?
Well, they, Kembrin, they were focusing particularly on glial changes, which are the sort of characteristic changes of injury that you get in postnatal brains. They did not find that. I'm not sufficiently expert on the techniques that they used to know how sensitive they were to that. The study by Bailey and his colleagues similarly looked, found some evidence in some individuals that were compatible with that, and again left open, as it were, the meaning of it. So we're based on a very small number of brains investigated in slightly different ways by different investigators that don't as yet end up with a coherent story. I'm optimistic that in the goodness of time they will, but until we're there, it's premature to build much of a theory on it.
I thought you had already told us that you didn't know whether Kemper had looked for neuroinflammation. I'm asking you to tell me what study you're referring to where they looked for neuroinflammation in the brain and
say
didn't find it.
She looked for glial changes. I don't know what range of techniques she used. I'd have to re-look at the papers. But again, I'm not a neuropathologist.
And then finally, Scott, pulling the last point there. and this is the point that Dr. Corshane and the Vargas and Pardo group have made in their review papers, that persistent neuroinflammation can explain the symptoms of autism. Do you agree with that particular point, that it can explain the symptoms of autism?
It's a speculative notion.
Now, every one of these points which come out of the published literature appeared in 2005 or later. You were first retained by the vaccine manufacturers on the thimerosal question, according to a report, sometime in early 2004. Is that right?
Yes.
So when you wrote the first draft of your report, none of this information was available to you.
True.
But when you wrote your report in this case, all of that was available to you, and yet you didn't. You didn't even discuss it, did you?
At this point, this has been, this line of questioning, Your Honor, has gone on time and again, and I've let it go on, but it deserves to be commented on. Dr. Rutter, the inference here is Dr. Rutter didn't mention this because it was part of the petitioner's case that he couldn't address. This was not part of the petitioner's case when he wrote his report. Neuroinflammation was not their case.
I don't think this is the time for argument.
Dr. Deeth made his theory present and known back at the time that Dr. Rutter was answering and gave his report. This three-week-old theory of neuroinflammation, I don't think that it's proper for this line of questioning to keep faulting Professor Rutter for not addressing something that he had to be somehow cognizant of before it was even presented by the petitioners.
Petitioner's counsel, how much further are we going with this line of questioning?
I just want to ask him if he agrees that is a coherent theory, even if you agree, even if you say it's not proven yet. Isn't it a coherent, biologically coherent theory?
It's a highly speculative theory, and it's not one that had been drawn to my attention at all in the case at the time I wrote my report. So that if I was redoing a new report, I would look at these papers, but I would have to, as I indicated, be very careful in indicating this is not a particular area of science on which I'm expert. So I would comment on it in terms of the causal inference. I'd not be prepared to comment on the details of the laboratory features. That's not my area of expertise.
So are you saying you can't say whether it's coherent or incoherent?
It's so general that you... It's difficult to say anything other than it's a speculative attempt to bring a general mechanism together in terms of accounting for a specific phenomenon.
Coherent or incoherent? What's your answer?
So vague that it's neither.
Let's talk about regression for a minute. I want to... you agree that I think that there have been cases, you've said you've seen them, where there is clear and even dramatic regression into autism of children who develop normally until they were 18 months of age, correct?
Yes. The dramatic is unusual, but I've certainly seen many cases of regression, yeah.
Now, you said that you thought regression was, on average, about a quarter of the cases.
Yes.
Are you aware of the study that was done in California called the CHARGE study? It's an epidemiological study of regressive autism.
I'm not quite sure I recognize that.
Let me show it to you. This is Petitioner's Master Reference List, Exhibit 562. And Scott, if you just pull up the title of the paper, we've already discussed this briefly before with another witness. The title is Regression in Autism, Prevalence and Associated Factors in the CHARGE Study. Have you not seen this paper before, Dr. Rutter?
I think I probably have, but I need to look through it properly to check.
And if you just blow up the abstract, I don't want to go into the details. I just want to ask you about the conclusion of the abstract here for now. Put the results, highlight the results section, if you would. In the results section, they say that 15% of the combined autism ASD group lost both language and social skills. 41% lost one or the other, and no differences were found between the two samples of children with regression. But do you agree that this epidemiological study conducted in California probably is the best measure we have right now of the percentage of autistic children who have both language and social skills regression?
Well, there are other studies. I don't know. I'd have to read it more carefully to say whether it's the best. It does, of course, come up with a combined figure of whatever it is, 56%. So it's actually saying over half have regressive autism.
But the children we're talking about in this case lost both social skills and language. And the study found that those type of children only occurred in 15% of the cases, correct?
Where does the fact that we're referring only to those who lost both come from?
The two cases that are at issue here today.
I see. Well, I've not looked at the individual cases, so I can't comment on that. But in the general evidence that I have seen, it's not been specified in that particular way. It's talked about definite regression. It's not said that it has to be in both language and social.
Now, you made a general comment on epidemiology that you thought if it was 25% of the population, of the autism population, that the ecological studies that have been conducted on autism rates over time compared to thimerosal vaccines would have picked it up. But are you aware that both Dr. Greenland and Dr. Goodman for the defense has said that if it's 15%, those studies would not have been able to pick it up?
I don't know that either. I think that's an unfair characterization of either witness. I'm certainly sure that it isn't Dr. Goodman's statement.
Well, let me ask the witness another question. Do you know what percentage of all autism they said would not be able to be picked up if it were a certain size? Do you know what numbers they used?
No. I have read Dr. Greenland's statement, his report. He doesn't deal with what the proportion is, but he does assume a very low rate, but he does so without reference to the literature on the reported studies looking at regression, so that he lands up with the perfectly legitimate point that if it is a very low rate, it wouldn't be picked up. Now, what rate would be picked up would depend on which study one's talking about. Obviously, the smaller the proportion, the less likely would it have been to be picked up. I mean, that is a general epidemiological finding, and of course I agree with that. I have not looked at the evidence sufficiently in relation to knowing which percentage would have been picked up and which wouldn't.
Do you know what Dr. Russ said about this issue, as to what percent of his patients he thought were truly regressing?
I don't think I do now.
You don't know that he said that of the patients that he has in his own clinic that were apparently regressive, that when he went back and looked carefully at them, only 20% of those cases were truly regressive. You're not aware of that.
I know, but I would question the basic assumption. The evidence to date, I think, suggests that regression isn't an either-or phenomenon. So that Dr. Kinsborn in his report talks about, in biology, continua are the usual. I don't remember exact words he used, but something of that kind. I agree with that statement. And my clinical experience over some half a century goes along with that in relation to regression. That's to say, there are some cases that are indeed severe and dramatic. There are others where much less so, and all the way along the line. And the evidence as to which cutoff you should use to identify a distinctive subgroup, I don't think we have the faintest idea where that should be. But the study here, for example, on just eyeballing it, because I haven't had time to read it properly, indicates that they found no differences between the two samples with regression or the children without loss of skills. So that the notion that there is a distinctive group, I query. I'm not saying it's impossible, But what I'm saying is it certainly has not been demonstrated, and it certainly has not been demonstrated that any group of that kind is medically different. It's a possibility worth studying, but hasn't been shown.
You can take that down, Scott. Now, let me ask you this squarely. What is your opinion as to whether there has been any measurable increase in the incidence of DSM-IV autism over the last 20 years?
I don't know. As a careful, rigorous scientist, it bothers me that I have to say something as vague as that. Let me put it this way. There is no doubt, and this would be generally agreed, that there is better ascertainment now than there used to be, and that will have certainly played a part in the rise. It's also the case, and again, as far as I know, nobody has disputed it, that the broadening of the concept is for real and has played a part. So the question comes then, does better ascertainment and a broadening of the concept fully account for the rise? And I know of no evidence that can rule that in or rule that out. But one of the studies that I am involved with, which is the Norwegian so-called MOBA study, Mothers and Babies study, following 100,000 children and mothers from pregnancy onwards, is looking at whether there are environmental risk factors that could be involved with autism. So I'm very heavily committed to the need to study not just genetic influences, but also possible environmental causes. But I do so on the grounds that it is reasonable with a multifactorial disorder like autism to suppose there are non-genetic factors, and it is the job of scientists like myself to strive to find them. I think that the evidence as to whether there is or is not a real rise, I don't think is worth investigating at the present time, because I don't see how you would ever know. You can't go back in history with measures that were not existent at the time. I am in favor of research that says, here is a hypothesis about something that might have caused a real rise. Let us investigate it. That was done with MMR, and it was done with thimerosal. And I think it was reasonable in both cases to look at the epidemiological evidence that it was associated with a real rise. In both cases, I think the evidence is against that having been responsible for a real rise. But clearly, when the suggestion was put forward, it needed to be investigated. And one of the key features that is most decisive is what happens when the risk factor, MMR in the one case, thimerosal in vaccines in the other, are removed. And so there is a need to look at this possibility. I don't know whether there's been a real rise. Okay.
You said that you thought in the modern era that the prevalence estimates now are reasonably accurate.
Yes, I do.
When did, and I assume that's post DSM-IV, is that right? The modern era?
Yes. I'm not a great adherence to official classification systems, despite the fact I was involved with both.
Well, but I thought what I was hearing you say is that we can reasonably rely on the prevalence estimates in more recent years.
Yes.
Of autism.
Yeah, and not because they rely on DSM-4 or CD-10, but because they use standardized instruments, they look carefully at confounding factors, they use good general population samples. I mean, they, as it were, remedied many of the problems of the earlier research. Whether they were helped or hindered by DSM-4 and ICD-10 is really neither here nor there. They were good epidemiology.
And when did we enter the modern era?
It's a bit like regression. It happened gradually over time.
Okay, but when we're there now, you don't know when the studies were published that we can trust, rely on their prevalence estimates? Studies published in the 1990s, after 1995, can we rely on studies published after 1995 as giving us accurate prevalence estimates?
I, as always, as any good scientist does not rely on the year. It looks at the quality of the research. And the quality of the research in the studies done in the last decade or so are definitely higher than those. Dr. Fombon has done analyses looking at particular year cutoffs. I think that's a sensible thing to be doing, but I actually don't have much faith that that actually gets you very far. I think looking at the quality of the research is the key thing.
Well, I think in your report you cite to the two studies done in Atlanta, actually in the United States, that estimated population rates of DSM-4 autism, and it came out to roughly 60 or 70 per 10,000. Is that what you believe is the current reasonably accurate prevalence estimate of autism in the, at least in the United States?
Well, I also pointed out that the variation in prevalence rates, even in the recent studies that rely on administrative figures, vary from state to state in a puzzling fashion, and I concluded in my report that I therefore don't place a lot of credence on administrative figures for true rates of incidence of autism. So whether the true figure is higher than that, or I doubt that it's much lower. The study by Gilliam Baird put it actually higher than that. So it's certainly somewhere between the 0.5% to 1%, which is way higher than the estimates of 50 years ago.
And this good epidemiological studies done in the last 10 years have been able to reasonably accurately measure the prevalence rate using those instruments you talked about.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I need to spend some time with him on the epidemiological studies. It's 1 o'clock. I assume this would be a good time to think about breaking. However, I want to ask you about Dr. Young's study that was published a couple weeks ago, and I want to make sure you have a copy now. So have you read the Young study?
No.
Let me give you a copy then you can have over lunch hour. This is Petitioner's Master Exhibit. No, it's a trial exhibit. We marked it, though, didn't we? No? Yes, we did. We gave it a...
665.
We gave it a number.
Petitioner's Master Reference List 0665.
665. I'll write that on here for you.
It's the Young and Geyer study.
With respect to that, Your Honor, obviously we'll see what we can do over the lunch hour, but I would like to have Professor Rutter have a chance to eat too. So
I don't mind taking a longer lunch. We have nothing. We've lost two other witnesses today. We have plenty of time.
The other characterization of this study as it being out for a couple of weeks, I think, would not be accurate. I think it's been out for a week now. Maybe the Petitioner's Council have been aware of it much longer than that, but as far as in front of the court, I think it was at the end of the Friday of the first week that was the first time we saw this study. Young Geyer and Geyer, I believe.
Right. With these representations, how long is counsel proposing for lunch? How much longer do you anticipate going?
Well, it depends on how long it takes to go through this study. I think it'll take a lot less time if he has a chance to read it first. I think I've probably got 45 more minutes.
An hour for lunch?
And I'm happy to take an hour and a half for lunch to give him more time to read it.
An hour should be sufficient.
An hour. I have 1 o'clock at this point, so we will take a lunch break and return and resume at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
Thank you.